Chapter 22. In Majdanek. The SS men welcomed us with their bellowing. They drove us out of the cars with rifle butts, yelling, "Get out, you Jewish pigs, you sows!" Men were pushed to the right side, women and children to the left. I took one last glance at my child before she disappeared in the crowd of women and children. My first look at the prisoners was horrifying. Almost all of them had psychosis, which I had never seen before. Their faces looked as if they had been smeared with cheap brown paint. Some of them wore striped prison uniforms. Others were dressed in civilian clothes, which were usually black with blue and red stripes on the backs. This was a completely new world for me, a world in which every word was shouted or screamed instead of spoken. We were ordered to undress. All possessions were taken from us. We were led to a big bathroom. Every possible human hiding place was checked. Our heads were shaved, and we received the striped clothes, striped caps, and Dutch wooden shoes. We were not registered, but each of us was given a number with his clothes. My number was 1377. I realized that my name was being crossed off the list of mankind. My name was no longer needed, nor would it be used. It could be forgotten. Majdanek was only 70 kilometers away from Majin. This region was known geologically for its black, fertile soil. For me, however, it was a kind of Sahara. All of Majdanek was yellow sand. Marching in wooden shoes, to the accompaniment of the shouts of the SS guards, was very difficult. After marching 3 to 4 kilometers, we reached Field 4 of Majdanek. There were 4 fields for men, and 1/5 of an adjoining field for women. The whole area was enclosed by barbed wire, and each individual field was encircled by an electric fence which was guarded. About 10,000 people worked in a field, and each field contained several large barracks, so-called blocks. I landed in Block 24. Majdanek was a torture and extermination camp. The prisoners were not assigned to practical work, with the exception of a very few who were assigned to administrative jobs. The indescribable painful roll call which took place every morning lasted several hours. Many were nearly beaten to death. They could be sure they would not be part of the evening roll call. Then we went to work, which meant we were forced to run in our wooden shoes to one corner of the field, where we filled our caps or the corner of our jackets either with wet sand, stone, or mud. From there we again ran to another corner, emptied the mud, replaced it with something new. Lines of SS officials and so-called prominent prisoners, equipped with clubs and whips, beat us along the way. It was hell. As a result of the beatings and exertion, many died or were injured. By orders of the capos and the SS, they were piled up on the side of the block so that they could be counted dead or alive at the evening roll call. I soon realized that this routine offered some good possibilities, so I sometimes was able to lay down between the dead and the half-dead to get some rest. The faces of the SS murderers and of their helpers who, armed with sticks, beat us as if we were wild animals and who overwhelmed us with blows have remained indelibly ingrained in my memory. Unforgettable are the martyrs, pale as ghosts from shock, dressed in striped uniforms, their heads and faces bloodied from blows. I remember them with broken eyeglasses, missing teeth, the tall ones in short trousers, the small ones in clothing too large for them, holding in both hands a cap filled with pebbles so it would be easier to beat them. I search for words and comparisons with which to describe these murderous orgies. I am forced to think of starving wolves and lions as they tear apart the flesh of their prey. One particularly dangerous torture was going to the toilet. It was a hole which measured about 10 by 20 meters and was partially covered by a roof. There were wooden beams around a round wooden ring, 10 centimeters across, which was fastened to the ground, and on which the prisoners sat while relieving themselves. Chief of the toilet was an old, well-known professional criminal, who was also called Scheißmeister. He used a club to hit prisoners as he pleased, and he determined the type and length of our stay in the toilet. He was authorized to mete out punishments on the spot. Other prominent criminals also came to the toilet to find alleged shirkers. As a first light punishment, one was beaten on one's naked backside. The prisoner's only chance was to run away with their pants in their hands and join the others who were carrying sandstones in their caps. The other popular punishment was to hit the sitting prisoner in the face or chest so that he fell into the shithole. During this ritual, laughing was permitted. As far as I know, many of these people drowned and their bodies remained in the hole. In Majdanek, even the toilet was transformed into a death trap. Food was very poor, never enough, and was served irregularly with all possible trickery. We slept in three plank beds in three levels. We were not allowed to leave the blocks at night. As soon as the sun set, we were locked in. Wooden tubs were placed in the corners for human needs. The walls of these tubs were so high that it was impossible to relieve oneself either standing or sitting. We therefore had to resort to all sorts of methods to reach the tubs. Dirtying the area around the tubs was punished by beatings. Nevertheless, it was always very dirty. The stench was horrible. When the barracks were open in the morning, carrying out the tubs and cleaning the block were the first reasons for beatings and tortures. In comparison with the Scheissmeister's realm, however, the tubs were a nuance bit easier. It was part of the program at Majdanek not only to torture people while they were eating and working, but also to make using the toilet a terrible ordeal. During the night, one could hear the last cries of martyred prisoners and the shouting of perpetrators. Even before sundown, wild screaming and scornful laughing were audible. These sounds came from the drinking parties of the eminent camp members. Suicides occurred again and again in the night. I'll never forget Dr. Nick, a Jewish doctor from Warsaw, who was well known and respected for his helpfulness. One morning we found him hanging by his belt. On that day he had learned that his wife, with whom he had arrived at Majdanek, had been gassed. The evening roll call was similar to the one in the morning, but in the evening, when seemingly endless counting was over, several numbers were called. Prisoners who answered to those numbers had to run out and report to the SS camp administration. These officials announced the number of lashes and other punishments which they were to receive. For this purpose there was a special wooden rack, which the prisoner had to mount, constricted so that his legs and body were rendered immovable, and his head hanged down. Vanya, a prominent Ukrainian prisoner in the service of the SS, sat on the head of the prisoner, while two SS men with leather whips administered 25, 50, or 100 lashes. The cries of these sufferers were loud and heartbreaking. The other prisoners were forced to watch and silently count the blows in unison, while they listened compassionately to the cries of their fellow prisoners. One heard and felt everything. The beaten prisoner was then taken, actually carried, to his block. This procedure was repeated 10 to 20 times each evening. Prisoners were often hanged. Every 10 to 14 days we were taken to a bath. During the time we spent under the showers waiting for water, we were beaten. I do not know whether it was intentional or not, but the water always came out ice-cold or extremely hot. After the showers, shirts were distributed. In early May, when it was still cold, we were given thin linen work shirts. As soon as it got warm, we received winter shirts of blue and white canvas on the outside and warm flannel on the inside. The shirts had a double seam in front which was full of lice. We sweated and were practically eaten alive by the insects. Because of bad food and the contracting of typhus, I had additional pains to bear. I suffered from scabies on my head, under my arms, on my backside, and between my fingers. I got a can of sulphur ointment from a fellow sufferer. It burned like fire, but brought some relief. It became intolerable. The lice were the worst part. The Majdanek torture machinery was so well planned that the SS spread terror amongst all the prisoners of all nations in all of the five fields of the camp, even though there were not enough of them to carry out this intimidation day and night. They therefore chose so-called prominent prisoners, who in each field and each block belonged to a different nationality. This privileged group was comprised mostly of the scum of mankind. They often acted in the service of the SS, or by their own volition, national prejudices. So it was that the Ukrainians took revenge on the Poles in Field 4, and the Poles on the Ukrainians in Field 3. Only we Jews were, of course, not included in this international competition of hatred. We were beaten everywhere. I will never forget the Russian prisoners of war, who in Field 4 were separated by an additional wire fence and were constantly under arrest. I can still see them standing and clinging to the fence. They were emaciated, thirsting for water, yearning for food, and dying like flies. Were those human beings who created this inferno and observed this scene without emotion? Yes, they were the SS. As a regular prisoner, without any function or privilege, I hardly had any opportunity to come into contact with the SS. Of course, I was cautious not to get too close to these people, so that I would not attract their attention. I never looked an SS man in the eye, not only out of disgust or aversion, but mostly out of fear. Fear was something we all experienced. I was lucky. Attracting the attention of the SS meant certain death. This is perhaps the most important reason I am alive today. During the years in the ghetto and the camps, the cruelest experience was to suffer being hit by a fellow victim. They were, of course, prisoner criminals of all nationalities. The most dangerous people, who were conspicuous in their brutality, were allowed to practice their sadism together with the SS. The first example of such torture that I observed was on the elder of our block, Moshe, who was known for his crudity and brutality. He had been a porter in Warsaw and was a tall and fat drunkard with a sodden voice, a blue nose, and rough manners. He addressed everyone as son of a bitch, and deprived prisoners of bread and soup in order to provide himself with cigarettes and liquor. He hit us in the morning and in the evening during roll calls, using the excuse that we were not in a straight line. In reality, he wanted to become the pet of the kapos and the SS. I often saw Moshe Pur kicking Jewish prisoners in the face or stomach so hard until they were half dead, and some actually died later. Naftali Gazlan, known as the Killer, was of the same caliber. He had been a thug in Warsaw, and they knew each other well. These two brutal underworld types were especially at home in Majdanek. One character who was unique, even in Majdanek, was a 15-year-old Jewish boy called Bubi. He was small, fat, well-dressed, and moved among the kapos, the prominent prisoners, and even close to the SS. The 10,000 prisoners of Field 4 were under his command, sometimes for hours. They were forced to carry out all of his orders. Attention! Caps on! Caps off! Right! Left! Keep in step! Double time! Line march! March! With club in hand and his childish voice, he ridiculed and taunted us to the full satisfaction of the SS. We found out that this boy was a pupil, dependent and accommodating in every way of the head capo. He had earned his reputation with the SS by putting the nooses around the necks of his father and mother in Majdanek. As a reward, he became what he was. I do not dare to judge this macabre tragedy. Perhaps a doctor or a psychologist could. After the war, I read a book by Paul Treppmann, in which he revealed that the head capo and his protege were later hanged in Majdanek. Vanya, the Ukrainian, was a murderer through and through, and always shouted curses and insults in the underworld. He had a hangman's face and a besotted voice. He would not walk three steps without beating or harassing anyone within reach. He would use his hands or his feet, or would spit on them, unless he had his thick wooden club with him, which he preferred to use. In the evening during roll call, he was at his bestial best and in the right environment. His place was at the whipping table on which the prisoners were beaten. It seemed to have been invented for him. He would smile when the whipping started, because that was his opportunity to prove his importance, usefulness, and indispensability. Cheerfully he would mount the head of the sentenced prisoner, moving like a winning rider on his horse. Above the cracking of the whip, one could hear Vanya's deep voice, and mingled with the victim's cries, his scornful laughter. Listening to this was enough to drive one insane. I had never seen, nor could I imagine, a specimen such as Vanya. Later on, I read about similar persons in Solzhenitsyn's Gulag Archipelago. But I, too, would come to personally experience Vanya's brutality. In that part of Majdanek in which I moved, there were no paved streets, but only sand and gravel. The only ones who drove on that street were the SS men on their bicycles, motorcycles, cars, and trucks. The traffic consisted exclusively of marching prisoners and work details. Male and female prisoners were harnessed by ropes and wires to a wagon and used instead of horses. Wagons were filled with wooden barrels and crates containing excrement, liquid manure, or other trash. Because of the heavy load, the wagon wheels sank deeply into the sand, and the ropes cut into the flesh of the prisoners, who, like horses, were driven on by the SS. It was an utterly depressing scene of inhuman slavery. The men and women prisoners on that street were a pathetic sight. Their heads were shaved, they were humiliated, sad, and cramped figures in dirty, striped clothes, who had lost or been robbed of their human features and their dignity. These people were brought to Majdanek to be tortured, until finally ended up as smoke pouring out of the crematory's chimney. Nowhere in the camp area of Majdanek did I see trees or grass, let alone flowers, fruit, or vegetables. Nothing green bloomed. I never saw any horses, cows, cats, chickens, geese, ducks, birds, or bees. I neither saw nor read a written or printed word, nor did I experience a quiet minute or a secure second, not even while dreaming. Human life had no value. Since the victims were fenced in, the challenge of hunting them was lost. Only the beast's desire for fun, torture, and killing remained. The camp was a playground created for murder, a reservation for death and extinction. And the sky, had it ever been blue there? I did not know. I was ashamed to look. I could not stand the light. Blue was not our colour. It was grey, and we inmates always looked down. We could expect nothing from above. Our future lay beneath us. The grey earth would soon consume our beaten bones or pulverized ash. One day gardeners were being sought to form a gardening detail for which I volunteered. Although I did not have the slightest knowledge of gardening, I was accepted. The detail was to be sent outside the camp. I was happy to have been chosen, and even considered the possibility of escaping, which the others probably did as well. The following morning the detail was formed into a group of 50 people. Accompanied by 2 capos and armed SS, we were led out of Field 4. Before leaving, we had to line up in rows of 5 and were counted repeatedly by capos and others. We then were ordered to sing and march in step. The first torture was marching in the open Dutch wooden shoes which we wore. In order to avoid losing our shoes in the deep sand, we had to spread our toes wide and push them against the wood. After a while, I thought that I would never get my toes straight again. On the march, we were assaulted by innumerable blows with rifle butts. We marched along the entrances to the 3 other fields, past the crematorium area and the adjoining warehouses, until we finally left the deep sand and reached a big field of ashes. The ground was warm and pliable. A strange smell hung in the air. We soon found out that a huge mass grave was located near the field of ashes. A special unit of French Jews, who were accommodated separately in the camp, was given the task of digging up the bodies, removing gold teeth, rings, etc., and then burning the remains. These corpses were then left from an earlier time, before Majdanek had crematorium. The SS wanted to cover all traces of the mass graves and thus hide their crimes from the outside world. The French Jews who were chosen for that job were very strong, but they were liquidated and replaced after several weeks. Every morning when we marched through the field, the ground was still warm and steaming. Depending on wind direction and air pressure, the odor of burnt flesh came either stronger or weaker, but it never disappeared entirely. During these marches, we also passed a part of the road which led from the arrival ramp to the camp. This was the one-way street of Majdanek, from which almost no one ever returned. We saw new transports arriving daily. We could even tell whether they came from the east or west. Those prisoners who came from the west wore hats, carried umbrellas, and the women had fur coats. The trains from the east looked like prisoner transports to Siberia. There were also trains from the Warsaw Ghetto, where the rebellion was still raging. Occasionally we were able to call out a few words to the new prisoners. All transports were guarded and accompanied by SS officials with their dogs. The poor prisoners walked silently amid shouted commands and the threats of loaded guns. But when we walked past them, we heard quiet cries and questions of desperation. The impression we made on these people was clear. We felt sorry for them because we knew what they could expect. One could find everything on this road to destiny. Currency of all countries, valuables, dolls, purses, shoes, combs, everything that the new arrivals had lost or thrown away in desperation. After 5 or 6 kilometers inside the outer fence of the camp, we reached our place of work. It bordered on the outside fence, was strictly guarded by the SS, and was situated on the road to Lublin. It was not exactly a plant nursery. We were ordered to dig up the soil and build a flower bed close by. Not far away from us, some Polish civilians were working, with whom one could occasionally talk, if our capos and foremen were bribed. Other work details could be seen in the distance. Sometimes even units of women walked past us. Despite the dangers involved, some civilians tried to establish contact with us to get jewels or other valuables in exchange for a piece of bread. Everyone in the commando assumed that these contacts would give them some advantage. Using a spade while wearing wooden shoes was extremely difficult. Although it had become very hot, it was strictly prohibited to undress. We almost sweated to death in our flannel winter shirts, which were also full of lice. These ate their way into our bodies. It was a tragic comic battle against a plague which one could hardly see, but always felt while itching and scratching constantly. We called the lice the Nazis' allies, and indeed that is what they were. It was a relief when we were allowed to go to the toilet, where we could take off our shirts and get rid of some of the more aggressive lice. Talk and conversation while working was not allowed. Blows with wooden slats or spades and cries of pain were their substitutes. After work, we were forced to carry half-dead prisoners back to the camp, since they had to report at roll call, dead or alive. The following day they were replaced by new prisoners, since most of them died in the meantime. In Majdanek there were no doctors, medicine or hospitals. Only a stone's throw away from our place of work we saw a peaceful road on which traffic passed, and on which on Sundays Polish farmers and their families went to church. Fortune smiled on me in that I didn't have to dig ditches at this time. I was ordered to set up flower beds. I defended myself as best I could against the lice, blows, and hunger, but I attempted the most in my fight against starvation. Next to Field 4 was a fenced-in barrack in which a group of specialists worked on hog's bristles. This allegedly vital production was transferred from the ghetto of Mijek to Majdanek. A former neighbor and good friend, Pesa Kavelblum, worked there. Thanks to good connections, I managed to get into that barracks for a short time. The employees there still had some gold and a few valuables, but little bread. Through my work as a gardener, I had become acquainted with a Polish civilian and Slovakian Jewish prisoner who had a special function in the camp and suggested that I trade money and valuables for bread. Slovaks had been among the first builders of the Majdanek camp, and those who still survived held important positions. With my job as gardener and my connections with the employees of the brush factory, I saw a chance to appease my hunger by trading. Thus I decided to starve for a day in order to get a one-day ration of bread, which I then took to Pesa Kavelblum. In return, I was given a gold coin. The next day I traded the coin to the Slovak in exchange for a four-day ration of bread. With two rations I was full, so I traded the rest of the bread and continued doing business in that way. That the bread was usually blue with mould did not bother me or my customers. We ate it anyway, and at least assuaged our hunger temporarily. One day, while passing a women's unit, I recognized a girl from my chevra, Sarah Nissenbaum, who had been in Warsaw with me. When I first saw her, I was greatly surprised and unhappy to see a member of my chevra in that hell. But then I wanted to know what had become of the chevra and my friends. I felt that since they were so close to me, that they were the only people in whom I still had faith after my family was gone. I had taken these friends to my heart. All my wishes and dreams were linked with and directed to them. In the hours of depression, when I wanted to feel better, I would think about my chevra. Then I believed that the chevra might continue to make history, and perhaps they were still playing cat and mouse with the Nazis, maybe achieving some success. That I had the misfortune to fall into this trap depressed me so much that I could only cry and pity myself. I sincerely hoped that my chevra was saved from the fate that befell me. In every arriving group of prisoners, I searched for familiar faces, and I was happy when I did not recognize anyone. When I noticed Sarah Nissenbaum, I thought that she must have felt the same way. They all assumed that I was dead, but there I was. I decided to risk everything in order to talk to Sarah. I had to use this one unexpected chance to find out what had happened to the chevra. I believed that I would then be able to die more easily or fight for my life with more faith. The uncertainty stifled me. In passing each other, we arranged a meeting close to where we were working and met on the next day. She spoke very fast, trying to use the minutes most effectively and to reduce the risk. She recounted the following story. The Gellerman brothers and Tovala Elfenbaum, who had wanted to rescue me from a Jidzek, went to the Warsaw Ghetto because of the hopelessness of the situation. After being denounced, she also went to the Warsaw Ghetto, and from there was transferred to Majdanek by coincidence. My friend Moshe Akhrizen, with whom I'd lived in the Kaczynski's house, returned to the suburbs of Radzin in order to hide there. No one heard from him again. The Kamieniecki sisters had given Aryan papers and their underground address in Warsaw to Miss Tisch of Majdanek, whom I had met in the ghetto. She was dark-haired and looked very Jewish. She was arrested on the train travelling to Warsaw and taken to the Gestapo and Majdanek. Under torture, she revealed everything. A few days later, the Gestapo man, Burger, from Radzin, who earlier in Radzin had helped both sisters and warned them not to procure Aryan papers, arrived at the Kamieniecki's apartment instead of Miss Tisch's. He reminded the sisters of his warning. To reaffirm his good intentions, he said that he would not shoot them as he did Miss Tisch. He arrested them and sent them to the Pawiak prison in Warsaw. In the end, it was the same. All the Jews in Pawiak were killed. That was my conversation with Sarah Nissenbaum. I gave her half a loaf of bread, and then with best wishes and tears in our eyes, we disappeared in opposite directions, regarding it as a miracle that we had not been caught. Talking to a woman was a major offence for an inmate of Majdanek. In spite of all the good wishes, I never saw her again. I had already expected bad news regarding my chevra, but at least I was given some more details. That was the last information I received to this day. Even after the war, I was not able to get any more details. Whenever a new book on Warsaw and the Holocaust appears, I look for the names of my chevra. So far, I have found nothing. Retrospectively, I am satisfied that my chevra, considering the circumstances, resisted and fought. This fact gave me the courage to persevere. I regarded it as my mission to continue fighting for life so that one day I could tell this sorrowful story. In the meantime, I had a terrible fear of starving to death. In no case did I want to die of hunger. I smuggled valuables, and the Slovak gave me bread, which was brown outside and blue with mold on the inside. In my Majdanek, it tasted like cake. I ate my fill and passed it on. One day, just after I had received a loaf of bread and buried it in a flower bed in order to smuggle it back to camp in the evening, an SS man who had been watching me was suddenly standing in front of me. He took the bread and ordered, "Bend down." Right there, he gave me 25 blows with a black rubber hose which was 6 to 7 centimeters thick. Then he wrote down my number. I knew what awaited me that evening. When we returned to the camp, I was tense. I expected to receive terrible punishment. Would I be able to withstand it? The evening roll call seemed to last an eternity. Every minute was like an hour. As usual, numbers were called out, prisoners were whipped. Counting the lashes was bad enough, but being whipped? Finally they called my number, 1377. I ran to the front, took off my cap, and as was customary in Majdanek, stood at attention. The secretary, an SS man, held the notice in his hands. I was not asked for a comment. He just said, 50. Immediately I was tied to Wanya's torture table with my feet in the raised block. He quickly grabbed my head and squeezed it between his legs. I heard my own cries of pain and accompanied by Wanya's laughter in rhythm with the blows of the whip. Thousands of prisoners counted. 1, 2, 3. The pain was unbearable. I cried as loud as I could. After 10 to 20 blows, my cries were stilled, and my pains were somehow different. I could not scream any more. The blows seemed as if they were falling on a wooden board. I did not even notice when they stopped. I only knew that it was over when Vanya dismounted my head. I saw the SS men wiping the sweat from their faces and rolling up their whips. They had beaten me with the thick part of the whip. The thin part was reserved for horses, the thick for Jews. Later in Auschwitz, I often saw one of these SS men. His name was Wieczorek. I do not know how I got back to the rows of my block. Leo probably guided or carried me. With help from Leo, who was in the same block, I reached my plank bed. He also made it possible for me to stay in bed for one day. After 75 blows on my already frail body, my physical condition on that day was pitiful. I felt as if my body were breaking into pieces. I could feel each individual part. Nothing was whole, and everything that was touched was bloody and injured. I was not mentally broken, however. When I came out of it, I saw people from my hometown and my block gathered around me. Wolf Turkeltaub, Bunim Zussmann, Leibisch Becker, Blumenfeld, and others. They asked me whether it would not be better to put up with the allocated rations than to risk such punishment. I told them that I thought that no way of dying was worse than starvation, and that any means we could use to avoid that fate was justified. Given the possibility, I would continue doing the same. After enduring so much, I felt that my age, and in my condition, hunger was for me the worst kind of suffering. It is impossible to describe the ordeal of starvation. Only one who has experienced hunger can feel and understand it. After 3 days, I returned to my work unit. I did not walk, I crawled. Because of the beatings, I could not sit down for the next 10 to 14 days. I did everything, literally everything, standing. My backside was black. The whiplashes could still be seen and counted. As paradoxical as it may sound, my wounds had an additional therapeutic effect, but I would not recommend this drastic remedy to anyone. My scabies, which mainly manifested itself as boils on my backside, had been pounded open by the blows. Although I had great difficulty tearing my shirt and pants away from the blood and pus which oozed from my wounds, no new boils formed. From this adventure, the elder of our block, Moshe Poer, inferred that I was an organizer. He did not know that I had smuggled moldy bread. He thought it was alcohol and sausage. He called me to him and said, "You son of a bitch, did you forget your block elder? If you want to live, you'd better remember him." Actually, I did not forget him. The next day I disappeared from his block out of fear. Pencils were rarely used in my Dunek. Hardly anyone wrote anything down, especially if it pertained to the treatment of Jews. No records were kept on that subject, in which blocks the victims were located and who was to die when were not important. Each one of us would have his turn. Thus it was possible to disappear into another block in the same field. It must have been during July-August of 1943 when the cases increased, in which prisoners were sporadically selected and transferred, whether to the crematoria or another concentration camp, no one knew. It is only natural for a prisoner to try to hide from his captors, but it was unimaginable that there could be another place in the world that was worse than Majdanek. With these thoughts, I decided to neither appear for a transport or to hide. It did not take long before I was caught. This time my conscience did not torture me any more. After the war, I learned that 4 to 6 weeks later, on October 16, 1943, all 18,000 Jews in Majdanek were shot in one day. To this day, I do not know how long I stayed in Majdanek. There were no calendars. We lived from one day to the next. It must have been 3 to 4 months, which was a remarkably long period of time for a simple prisoner in Majdanek. Sometimes I thought that I had spent my entire life there. That is how slowly and painfully time passed. But I was still living, and it seemed that I would soon leave Majdanek alive. That moment arrived. In a disorderly fashion, we were sorted and loaded into cattle cars in groups of 40 to 60 people each. We were treated like dangerous criminals. Four groups of prisoners sat in semicircles on the floor, holding their hands out in front of them so that every movement could be controlled. Talking was strictly forbidden. Two SS men with carbines sat on stools at the car door, watching us continually. Any improper or conspicuous movement was punished with blows of their carbine butts. It was actually a good sign that we were treated as criminals, instead of uncounted merchandise for the crematory.